This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Welcome to National Geographic. I'm Susan Shackelford. Today's first article is called Fashion's Desert Graveyard. Clothing from many of the world's favorite brands lies in discarded heaps in Chile's Atacama Desert. How it got there tells the story of modern fast fashion. This was written by John Bartlett with photos by Tamara Marino. The Atacama Desert in northern Chile stretches from the Pacific to the Andes across a barren expanse of red-orange rock canyons and peaks. As one of the driest deserts on Earth, it's a bucket list destination for stargazing tourists who come for some of the clearest views of the night sky. With its arid, rocky landscape so closely resembling Mars, the desert has even attracted the attention of NASA, which has tested rovers there. But the Atacama has also attained a less wondrous distinction as one of the world's fastest-growing dumps of discarded clothes, thanks to the rapid mass production of inexpensive attire known as fast fashion. The phenomenon has created so much waste that the UN calls it an environmental and social emergency. The challenge is turning off that tap. The numbers tell the tale. Between 2000 and 2014, clothing production doubled and consumers began buying 60% more clothes and wearing them for half as long as they once did. Three-fifths of all clothing is estimated to end up in landfills or incinerators within a year of production. That can translate to a truckload of used clothing dumped or burned every second. Most of the facilities are in South Asia or Africa, where the nations receiving those loads cannot handle the amount. A landfill near Accra, Ghana's capital, that is said to be 60% clothes and 65 feet high, has gained international notoriety as a symbol of the crisis. The scene in northern Chile has been dubbed in one online video, the Great Fashion Garbage Patch, a terrestrial variation of the better-known Great Pacific Garbage Patch. Colossal piles of discarded clothes with labels from all over the world stretch as far as the eye can see on the outskirts of Alto Hospicio, a hard-scrabble city of 120,000 residents. In one ravine, a pile of jeans and suit jackets, bleached by the harsh sun, rises above a mound of fake fur coats and dress shirts, some still bearing price tags. Bottles, bags, and other trash are mixed in. As images of the clothing heaps spread on the internet, many Chileans express surprise. "I was shocked to think that we were becoming the textile dump for developed countries," says Franklin Zepeda, a director of a company that focuses on circular economic practices. But the story of how the South American nation came to be a repository for the world's apparel rejects has as much to do with globalization and trade as it does with fleeting style trends. At first glance, it might seem that an isolated desert nearly 1,000 miles from Chile's population centers would be an unlikely destination for fast fashion's discards. But the country is also home to one of South America's largest duty-free ports, located in the coastal city of Iquique on the Atacama's western edge. Millions of tons of clothes arrive annually from Europe, Asia, and the Americas. Last year's tally was 46 million tons, according to Chilean customs statistics. Duty-free ports encourage economic activity, as goods are imported and often re-exported without the usual taxes and fees. The duty-free port was established in Iquique in 1975 to help generate jobs and improve an ailing local economy. Chile became one of the world's largest importers of used clothes, which transformed Iquique. As fast fashion exploded, so did imports. The Zona Franca, free zone, was a true revolution for the city's residents, says Bernardo Guerrero, a sociologist at Fundación Crear, an organization that studies Iquique's history and culture. They suddenly had access to things they could never have imagined, like their own car. Apparel began washing in and out of Iquique like waves as global fashions changed. Guerrero recalls a time in the 1990s when almost everybody in the city wore the same style of puffer jacket after large shipments of them arrived. It was a sign of what was to come. About 2,000 businesses of all types now operate in the duty-free zone. More than half are foreign. Hand-painted brand logos adorn warehouse doorways, and stacks of used cars, another major import, tower over the narrow streets. The free zone has also developed into a sorting depot for textile waste. In essence, we are just recycling the world's clothes, says Mehmet Yildiz, who arrived in Chile from his native Turkey 2 decades ago and operates a clothing import business named Dilara. Yildiz brings in clothes from the United States and Europe, most of them from thrift stores such as Goodwill. Once the garments reach Iquique, workers separate them into 4 categories, ranging from premium to poor quality. Yildiz then exports the best to the Dominican Republic, Panama, Asia, Africa, and even back to the U.S. for resale. Clothing that the importers don't want ends up in the hands of truck drivers, who ferry it a few miles to the dump outside Alto Hospicio, where it goes through another cycle of sorting and resale in small shops and street markets or at La Quebradilla, a huge open-air market. There, a roaring used clothes trade continues on a half-mile-long strip of some 7,000 stalls. A recent visit turned up faded T-shirts commemorating the 2001 U.S. Open golf tournament, a jacket emblazoned with the logo of a Texas police force, and a wool hat with the badge of a California university, among a sea of other cast-offs. Clothing that doesn't sell at the market is destined for the desert, and much of it is made from synthetic materials that won't biodegrade. Scavengers salvage what goods they can. On a cool afternoon, a woman named Genesis rummaged through a pile of formal clothes, nurses' uniforms, underwear, and Crocs, taking fleeces and blankets for the cold nights and earmarking the better garments to sell at La Quebradilla, where they may fetch a handful of coins. "Everything is useful to me," she said brightly, laughing as she imagined herself in a brand new summer dress printed with strawberries. "We're lucky to have found this." As helpful as resale markets might have been in an earlier era, they've been overwhelmed by the sheer scale of the mounting discards. New efforts, large and small, are underway to deal with clothing waste, and attention to the mess in the desert may inspire additional projects. In 2018, Franklin Zepeda founded a startup that manufactures building insulation panels from textile waste. "I was motivated by the idea that there was a vast quantity of waste that could perfectly be transformed into raw materials to make new products, reducing the amount of clothes in our desert," he says. Another startup, EcoCytex, based in Santiago, makes yarn from discarded clothes. "Our mission is to eliminate textile waste from Chile," says Rosario Avia, EcoCytex owner. "It made me so angry that there wasn't a solution, so I've thrown myself into solving it." Meanwhile, in Iquique, the clothing importer Dilara plans to open a recycling plant this year to make fillings for couch cushions from used clothes. These are small but crucial steps. The most promising solution, one that can handle the problem's scale, lies in the hands of the Chilean government. The World Bank forecasts 3.4 billion tons of garbage will be created every year by 2050. As it piles up, many countries are requiring manufacturers to take responsibility for their products at the end of those products' lives. Policies known as extended producer responsibility have been adopted in India, Australia, Japan, Canada, and some U.S. states. In 2016, Chile passed a version into law calling it Extended Liability of the Producer, or Ley REP for short. The law makes producers and importers accountable for six categories of waste: lubricant oils, electronics, batteries, small batteries, containers and packaging, and tires. Initially, textiles were not listed. Tomás Sayeg, who heads the Chilean Environment Ministry's Circular Economy Office, says a team is working to add three more product types to the Ley REP, including textiles. The most important thing is to turn off the tap, so to speak, so that these clothes don't keep ending up in the desert, he says. Converting Chile from a junkyard into a recycling hub would be the dream. In the meantime, must-have trends blink in and out of fashion, online sales keep churning, and mountains of forgotten clothes continue to grow amid the red sands of the Atacama Desert. One of the pictures that accompanies this article is of a woman selling tea from a cart in La Quebradilla, that market in Alto Hospicio that the article mentioned. It says merchants there pay $20 for 1,320-pound bales of used clothing, and they resell the garments for roughly 12 cents to $2 each. There's also a bit of text that's related to this story called The Toll of Textiles. Fashion may strive for glamour, but the industry is one of the world's largest greenhouse gas polluters. Over the past two decades, the number of new garments made per year has nearly doubled. Fast fashion purchases are soaring, as is the speed at which people discard cheaply made clothes. Low prices belie the environmental cost of producing the huge volume of fabric needed to feed the growth, with impacts varying by fabric type. Producing cloth from natural fibers, cotton, wool, hemp, and those made from wool pulp, man-made cellulosic fibers, or MMCFs, use the least energy, but requires more water than cheaper synthetics such as polyester and nylon. Hemp, the most sustainable in the quilt shown on this accompanying picture, accounts for just 0.26% of global textile production. And we have the four environmental impacts of fibers. So for energy consumption, every year the global fashion and shoe industries use twice as much energy as all of India does. To give you an idea of where some common fabrics fall in this environmental impact, looking at energy consumption first, polyamide, also known as nylon, comes in with 72.6 kilowatt hours per pound of polyamide. So its energy consumption is large. Wool, such as cashmere, fleece, and tweed, come in at 54.4. Polyester at 49. Those wood pulp fabrics, the MMCFs, like viscose, lyocell, and modal, come in at 38.5. Cotton is at 21.8, and hemp is at 10. Now, when we get to CO2 emissions, wool is it emits nearly 8 times as much carbon as cotton production does. Next would come polyamide, then the wood pulp MMCFs, then polyester, then hemp, and cotton would be the least for CO2 emissions. In terms of freshwater consumption, we would see that cotton takes up the most water-intensive material. Cotton accounts for about 25% of global fiber production, and it uses 186.8 gallons of water per pound of cotton. Wool comes in second, and then we have MMCFs, followed by hemp, polyamide, and finally polyester. In terms of waste buildup, polyester is the worst offender, with 59.5 million tons of polyester produced annually, Burned polyester releases greenhouse gases. When landfilled, it leaches chemicals into the soil. And that's followed in terms of the least desirable by cotton, then MMCFs, then polyamides, wool, and finally hemp. Next, we have a section called From the Archives, and the first part of it is Evolving Beasts. Staying on the edge of dinosaur discoveries means the view is always changing. Written by Daniel Stone. With a fourth Jurassic World movie in the works, our fascination with dinosaurs shows no signs of slowing, especially for series superstars Tyrannosaurus Rex and other theropods. Ever since these beasts were first unearthed more than a century ago, National Geographic has been reporting on them, pairing the latest science with vivid illustrations. With every new discovery, our depictions must evolve. And they show examples with this article. Starting in 1919, a magazine feature laid the foundation, describing an Albertosaurus as a powerful flesh eater that was capable of destroying any of its herb-eating relatives. 23 years later, battling T-Rexes appeared in our pages, standing some 20 feet in height. 3.5 decades after that, a 1978 cover story reported that T-Rex was even larger, 50 feet and 6 tons of bad news. Until the late 1990s, most dinosaurs were shown with scaly reptilian skin, but theropod skeletons found in China suggested young T-Rexes had feathers. That led to another new conclusion. We can now say that birds are theropods just as confidently as we say humans are mammals. And theropods may not have been the unstoppable killers of human fantasy. Discoveries in 2003 revealed that they were selective in their violence and submissive at times. In 2020, we reported that paleontology was in the midst of another revolution, one fueled by a wealth of fresh fossils and innovative research techniques. Even the latest renditions won't necessarily be definitive, but will be steps toward a clearer picture of these marvels from the past. Next, we have the decisive dish towel. This humble, little-known item helped bring the American Civil War to an end. Written by Sarah Kuta. With Union troops surrounding his Confederate army in Appomattox, Virginia, on April 9, 1865, General Robert E. Lee decided he had no choice but to initiate surrender talks. He sent a staff officer across enemy lines to ask for a ceasefire until he could meet with Lieutenant General Ulysses S. Grant. To pass safely, Confederate officer Captain R.M. Sims carried a fringed white dish towel with 3 thin red stripes running across the bottom. Today, half of that towel, known as the Confederate Flag of Truce, sits inside a glass case in the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of American History, on display as part of the exhibit, The American Presidency. Now discolored with age, this often overlooked artifact played a key role in one of the most pivotal moments in the nation's history. It's a national treasure, says James Farragan, a consulting vexillologist and an officer of the North American Vexillological Association, a nonprofit dedicated to the study of flags. It's the flag that began the discussion that ended the bloodiest conflict in American history. Why a dish towel? Throughout history, flags of truce, also known as flags of parley, were nearly always household items like towels, sheets, and pillowcases. No army in the world issues this flag because it's counterproductive to morale, says Farragan. And so, if things aren't going your way and you have to go chat with the guy with the bigger guns and more guys, well, then you have to find something. In this case, Sims' dish towel signal enabled Lee to meet cordially with Grant at Appomattox Courthouse, where Lee and his troops formally surrendered, a moment that many people consider to be the Civil War's de facto conclusion. But there was more tragedy ahead. 5 days later, John Wilkes Booth shot and killed President Abraham Lincoln. Fighting between the North and South dragged on for another year and a half, until President Andrew Johnson formally declared the end of the conflict in August 1866. Much to Simms's chagrin, the flag of truce eventually ended up in Union hands. Colonel Whitaker asked me if I would give him the towel to preserve that I had used as a flag. I replied, "I will see you in hell first. It is sufficiently humiliating to have had to carry it and exhibit it, and I shall not let you preserve it as a monument of our defeat." Simms wrote in a May 1886 letter describing his role in the surrender. After the war, General Philip Sheridan presented the flag to General George Custer's wife, Elizabeth, in appreciation of the loyal service performed by her husband. Upon her death, she bequeathed it to the United States National Museum, the precursor to today's national museums. It's been part of that collection since 1936. Somewhere along the way, it was cut in half. The missing piece's location remains a mystery. Though the surrender occurred nearly 160 years ago, the dish towel's symbolism continues to evolve over time. The amazing thing about objects is they come to carry, physically and metaphorically, the emotions and importance of a moment, which is why we save them, says Lisa Kathleen Grady, the curator in the Smithsonian's Political History Division, who put together the American Presidency display. But the interpretation depends on who's looking at it. It could be seen as a moment of bitterness or a moment of victory. The same is true for a better-known remnant of the Civil War, the Confederate battle flag. While the flag of truce remains largely unknown, the Confederate battle flag has become an enduring and ubiquitous symbol of racism. Artist Sonia Clark, a professor of art and the history of art at Amherst College, explored the contrasting legacies of the flags in her 2019 exhibit, Monumental Cloth, The Flag We Should Know, held at the Fabric Workshop and Museum in Philadelphia. With that show, she asked viewers to imagine a world in which the peace-brokering flag of truce, instead of the divisive Confederate battle flag, dominated the American narrative. 5 years later, as the deaths of George Floyd and many others have sparked an ongoing U.S. reckoning on race, amid President Biden's warning that white supremacy has become the most dangerous terrorist threat to our homeland, Clark's feelings about the flag's meaning have gotten more complex. What progress have we made, she asks. Really, what was surrendered? Our next article is a compilation of mostly photographs from National Geographic archives. It's called Extraordinary Moments. With a new documentary series exploring their work, National Geographic photographers share the stories behind their most iconic images. The first one is from Jimmy Chin in Yosemite National Park, California. It's Alex Honnold navigating El Capitan's traverse pitch without safety gear. Jimmy Chin, who took this photo in 2017 for National Geographic, says the best photographers share a commitment bordering upon obsession with what they are shooting. And so many people saw this still photograph as well as a documentary about Honnold's El Capitan climb. It's a very well-known image now. Next, we see from Anand Varma from Montreal, Quebec. He took thousands of frames of a ladybug clutching a braconid wasp's cocoon for the cover of the November 2014 issue. The wasp larva developed inside the spotted lady beetle. Just before the wasp emerged to spin a cocoon, it paralyzed its host. Something in the process made the ladybug twitch like a zombie. Readers wrote to Varma confessing that they used to dislike insects, but his picture had opened their eyes. Or, as Varma puts it, "I used to think bugs were gross, but now I think they're cool." And so you can see this ladybug sort of lit from within with this cocoon. It looks as if it's holding the cocoon rather than the cocoon being a part of the ladybug, and indeed an unwelcome part of the ladybug. Here's the text that goes with this article. What kind of person chases a tornado or dives among sharks or travels into a conflict zone all for a photograph? Jimmy Chin, mountain climber, skier, photographer, filmmaker, wondered this as a child growing up in Minnesota, flipping through the pages of his family's copies of National Geographic. When he picked up photography in his 20s, his goal was to shoot for the magazine. Joining the ranks of National Geographic photographers in 2002, he has since shown how far or high he'll go for a picture. As his friend and fellow climber Alex Honnold attempted a ropeless ascent of the El Capitan rock formation in Yosemite National Park in 2017, Chin dangled from a safety line nearby, more than 2,000 feet above the valley floor. Honnold's death-defying feat also became the Oscar-winning National Geographic documentary that I mentioned, Free Solo, directed by Chin and Elizabeth Chaya Vasarhelyi, his wife and creative partner. For a new series, the two National Geographic explorers turned the camera on photographers. In March, they debuted Photographer, 6 episodes that embed viewers with some of the world's most extraordinary visual storytellers, as Chin describes them. We've always been interested in stories about people who are pushing the edges of the human experience. Doing something that's never been done or capturing an image that's never been seen arises from the same instinct, he explains. Dedication to craft unites the show's featured photographers. From the tiniest animals to a final flight into space, the following images sample their work and the stories behind them. And so we've gone from that tiny insect to a picture from Imperial, Nebraska. Crystal Wright is the photographer. She's also a storm chaser. And she and fellow storm chasers arrived on the scene just as a supercell storm spitting lightning threatened a farm with a UFO-like mothership formation in May 2019. The team's timing that day was sheer luck, Wright recalls. After retreating from a storm in Colorado that pounded their SUV with hail, they crossed into Nebraska and caught up to the system at the apex of its power. It does look very, well, I would say it's dreadful. It's something that, an image that can't help but fill you with dread. Here's a quote from Crystal Wright. It's a tough thing to see because you feel this contradiction. On one hand, it's like, just like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm witnessing this absolute phenomenon. But then at the same time, particularly when it's going through a town, you realize, well, this is absolutely destroying lives. The lightning flashes in this photo look as if someone drew them in with a pencil. They're so thin and precise. Next, we have a picture from Mohammed Muhassin in Jordan. Zahra Mahmoud, photographed here at age 7 in 2018, lives in a tent in Jordan. Mohammed Muhassin, a National Geographic explorer who documents refugee crises, met Zahra and her family in 2015, soon after they fled the war in their native Syria. Every year he visits them at the encampment and photographs Zahra, who's now a teenager. Muhassin says he'll continue telling the family's story until they're in a more permanent living situation. He says, if you want to be able to capture the right emotion, to capture the image, you have to respect the people and you have to gain their trust. It's not something you buy or sell. It's something you invest. It's a long-term investment. And we need to stop there for this week. I hope you'll come back next week for more of National Geographic. I'm Susan Shackelford, and I thank you for listening.